You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha. This is Lecture 7 entitled The Roman Emperors, Paganism, and Christianity. One of the greatest figures in the history of the world is that of the successor of Constantine, Julian the Apostate, as he is called, who fell by the hand of an assassin during an expedition against the Persians in the year 363. In Julian, we have a figure that enters in a very special way into the history of the development of Western Europe, one in whom it is seen how throughout the whole course of the world's evolution, forces that are opposed to each other must be active in order that this evolution as a whole may come about in a fitting manner. In previous lectures, we have seen in Constantine a personality who, in a certain sense, had broken with the old principle of force employed by some of the earlier Caesars, for I had shown how the greater number of these called to their aid the principle of force in order to have themselves initiated into the mysteries. Instead of doing this, Constantine undertook everything which he thought would conduce to the external dominance of Christianity. From the first, from his very entrance into the world, Julian was regarded in the worst possible light by the imperial family and all its dependents. It is entirely in accordance with the age with which we are dealing that, even before birth, an individual such as Julian should have been preceded by all kinds of prophecies and soothsayings. The family was forced by Sibylline oracles to believe that the impulse that was active in the Emperor Constantine would evoke its direct opposite in Julian. From the first, therefore, they tried to prevent his being raised to the dignity of Caesar. It was decided that he should be murdered. All arrangements had been made to have him killed, along with his brother, while still a child. There was something which might almost be called an aura, which filled the whole surroundings of Julian with horrors. We can gather from countless stories connected with his person that there was something in him that was inimical to the recognized point of view of the day. When, as a young man, he took part in a military expedition into Gaul, a somnambulist cried out as the army passed by, quote, "There is the man who will re-establish the old gods and their images." Close quote. We have to see, therefore, in the rise of Julian something of deep significance, of profound spiritual import. As often happens in such cases, he was allowed to live from fear that his murder might bring greater evils than if he were permitted to live. And people consoled themselves by saying, quote, "Whatever he attempts in opposition to the efforts of Constantine can soon be frustrated," close quote. As a fact, all sorts of precautions were taken to render ineffectual those tendencies which were implanted in Julian. In the first place, it was determined to give him a thoroughly Christian upbringing, according to the ideas of Constantine. This Julian did not wish to receive. It did not appeal to his soul, for his soul, above all else, was fired when he was able to lay his hands on any Hellenic literature. When such strong forces as these are present, they conquer in the end, and so it came to pass. Just because those who were about him sought to withhold him from what they considered dangerous surroundings, he was driven into the arms of all kinds of Hellenistic instructors, and he became thoroughly conversant with literature and teachings of Greece. Julian learned, as he grew older, that the wisdom of Greece lived on in the Neoplatonic philosophies, with the result that eventually he was initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries. Thus it happened that after the ruling power of Rome had, in a way, been severed from the principle of initiation, an initiate once more in the person of Julian, sat on the throne of the Caesars. Everything that Julian did has to be regarded from the point of view of this initiation into the mysteries of Eleusis. And history has taken care to misrepresent his actions in every possible way. We can only arrive at a true conception of such a man when we are able to appreciate to the full the effects of this initiation. What did the soul of Julian gain through his having passed through the Eleusinian initiation? He learned thereby the facts of cosmic life, the coming into being of the world, by direct vision of his soul. He learned the spiritual origin of the world, and how it had come to pass within the planetary and solar systems. He learned certain things which, with the exception of a few initiates, were quite incomprehensible to the rest of the world at that time. For example, he learned the relationship of the forces and influences of the sun. He understood the meaning of the ancient saying of Pythagoras, quote, "Thou shalt not speak against the sun," S-U-N, close quote. All this had entered into his soul. This naturally does not refer to the physical sun, but to that spirit which is concealed behind the sun. He knew also, in accordance with ancient sacred tradition, that in the realm of the soul and spirit, the sun must be regarded as the actual origin of the world, and above all, that it must be regarded as that with which man must establish a connection if he is to reach back to the wellspring of his existence. Do but think of it. Before the soul of Julian arose, all this ancient sun wisdom, the fact that the sun our eyes behold is but the outer physical form of a psycho-spiritual sun quality, and that this can be made to live within the soul of man through initiation, that when it has come to life, the soul is able to speak of the hidden things of the cosmos, the great world, and also of the ordinary life of man here on earth. It was clear to Julian that nothing could ever be learned about these things merely through the human understanding which is associated with the brain of man, that the only reliable information about the world was to be had from those who were able to hold intercourse with the sun logos. He felt forced to acknowledge that a common law ruled the movements of the heavenly bodies, and those great movements which occurred among men in the course of history. We feel moved to ask, was not such a church father as the saintly Chrysostom convinced of the existence of a spiritual sun mystery? Did he not know there was a secret regarding the spiritual sun? Had he not been able to rise to comprehension of the saying, quote, "The sun so blinds men on earth that they cannot get beyond it to the spiritual sun," close quote. When we consider all the surroundings of Chrysostom, whose soul was still illumined by this ray of wisdom from olden times, we are forced to admit that hardly a remnant remained of that ancient understanding whereby the soul was enabled to receive into it the secrets of the universe, as communicated in the mysteries, and as they certainly were communicated to Julian, who was one of the last to receive them. Julian was surrounded by people who thought in the same way as did Constantine, but it is a fact that up to the end of the 9th century, people appeared every now and then in the West, great outstanding personalities, even among the papists, who were still stirred by the ancient secret wisdom. The special activities directed from Rome tended, however, to make the efforts of such individuals ineffectual, and also tended to develop a quite peculiar policy regarding the teachings of the ancient mysteries. Julian met in his environment with only a very external form of Christianity. But through a complicated process in his peculiar psychology, which is difficult to describe, he eventually evolved the thought, how would it be if one were able to make use of what has remained to our day as a last relic of the ancient initiation, and could employ it to bring about a continuity in the advance of evolution. I want you to understand that Julian was no opponent of Christianity. He was only an adherent of the continuance of Greek culture. We approach his personality more closely when we describe him as being rather a furtherer of Greek culture than an opponent of Christianity. His power and ardent zeal came really from his desire that Hellenism should not be allowed to die out, but that it should rather give birth to a continuous stream of evolution, so that it might be handed down to later generations. Julian was opposed to any sharp division or to any radical change. He was a very great personality. Since his initiation, Julian was aware that the things he sought to undertake could not be undertaken by one who was not in close union with the spiritual forces that dwell in everything in this world of the senses. He knew that if a man desires to introduce impulses into the evolution of the world, by methods only to be found in the world of the senses, and in the ordinary life of the soul, he is, according to Pythagoras, quote, speaking against the sun, close quote. Julian did not desire this, but quite the opposite. In fact, he desired to undertake one of the greatest combats in human evolution that it is possible to imagine. Now we must not forget that even at that time Rome was opposed to any such attempt being made. Nor must we forget that throughout the whole of southern Europe there was a loud objection to it. Remember that at the time of Constantine there still remained scattered among the people a remnant, even if it was the very last remnant, of spiritual aptitudes. The question of the miracles remains at the present day a specially crucial point in the expounding of the Gospels, for the reason that people never will read these from the standpoint of the age to which they belong. The question of the miracles had no special importance for the contemporaries of the evangelists, for it was well known to them that there were certain conditions under which persons could draw forces from the spiritual world which they were able to control. Now, in the same degree in which Christianity progressed outwardly and politically, reaching its summit in the time of Constantine, it declined spiritually, that is, as regards its spiritual achievements. Law after law was promulgated by Rome, forbidding acts of any kind that derived their power from the spiritual world. It is true these laws were clothed in a form that stated, "The old superstitions must cease. No person may perform any act of a magic nature, or by the aid of spiritual powers, so as to injure others. No one may hold intercourse with the dead," and so on. Many such laws were made. But behind the laws was the desire to extirpate, root and branch, all that remained of the spiritual accomplishments of olden times. And it is a fact that wherever possible, history has endeavored to hush up and conceal the feeling then prevailing. Our earliest historical records were produced in the cloisters by priests and monks, and it was the earnest endeavor of those who wrote the records to conceal the true characteristics of ancient times, and even to prevent what was most essential from reaching posterity. Thus it was that Julian regarded the ancient world that was vanishing in quite another light from that in which Constantine beheld it. Through his initiation, he knew the connection that existed between the human soul and the spiritual world. He knew this most surely. In the task he had undertaken, he could only hope to make use in some way of the powers of the ancient principle of initiation so as to bring about continuity in the forward course of human evolution, and so in some degree to oppose the form of evolution that was going on all around him. Because of his initiation, Julian was possessed of the most profound, the most reverent love of truth, a love of truth such as a man like Constantine had naturally no idea of. One might say that the very serious manner in which Julian regarded truth is hardly to be found in like intensity throughout the whole subsequent course of Western civilization. Because of this deep instinct for truth that had been stimulated by his initiation, Julian recognized all that had resulted from the teaching of both the higher and the lower schools of his day. The Christian dogma, as evolved at that time, had been introduced into the schools since the time of Constantine. The teachers accepted these dogmas, and from that standpoint gave instruction in the ancient Greek writers who had preserved as an integral element of their works the figures of Zeus, Apollo, Pallas Athena, Aphrodite, Mercury, and the other gods of the olden time. In Julian's soul, the thought arose, what are all these teachers really accomplishing? Dare any of these teachers imagine he is suited to expound writings that are founded entirely on the fact that the writers felt the old gods within their souls as a true impulse? Dare these teachers consider themselves fitted to interpret such writings when, because of the dogmas they hold, they are absolutely opposed to the very idea of the existence of these gods? To Julian's instinct for truth, this seemed impossible. He, therefore, forbade all those who, from their Christian dogma, were unable to believe in the old gods, to expound the ancient writings in the schools. What Julian desired was thoroughly to incorporate the olden teachings with the thought movement of the day, which had, of necessity, a different viewpoint. The Gospels were in his hands. These had come to him in a manner which differed widely from the way in which wisdom was imparted to him in the Eleusinian mysteries. He could not feel certain as to how the Gospels had arisen. He said to himself, if that which comes from Christ is a living principle, then it must also be possible to find it in the mysteries, for it must of necessity have dwelt in the depths of the mysteries. Julian desired to make a great experiment. He wished to see if it were not possible to continue the ancient mystery wisdom. He, of course, only knew of Christianity what it had become in his day. He wished to make a great experiment in respect of Christianity, to put it to the proof at a specific moment. Not the kind of proof that could be estimated by human means alone, that would have seemed to him childish, but he wished to carry out some act that would have meaning as regards events in the spiritual world. Julian argued in this way. Christ foretold that the temple at Jerusalem would be destroyed, that no stone of it would remain standing on another. This has come to pass. But if such a prophecy were to fail, if it were to prove abortive, then Christianity could not make good. Julian determined, therefore, to rebuild the temple at Jerusalem at great cost, in accordance with the custom of the time. And it actually happened that a large number of workmen were assembled to begin the reconstruction of the temple. Now this whole matter has to be considered from a spiritual standpoint. It was not men alone, but gods that Julian challenged. It is an undoubted fact, and can be proved historically, that each of the workmen who began work on the temple saw visions. Flames of fire shot out on them as they worked, and finally the men had to be withdrawn. The undertaking was abandoned. But we have seen with what high hopes Julian had made the attempt. After the demonstration by which Julian essayed to annul the prophecy about the temple had proved abortive before the whole world, he made an attempt from another side, and this was no less sublime in conception than the first. The time had not yet come when there passed over European culture that wave of evolution which had its source in the fact that one of the great fathers of the Church, Augustus, had been unable to rise to a certain idea. You perhaps know from history that Augustus was a Manichaean. This form of teaching had its origin in Persia, and maintained that it understood Jesus Christ better than either Rome or Constantinople. Manichaeism, the last word in respect of which it is unfortunately impossible to give out, even in such a circle as this, had filtered through into Europe in later days in various forms. In a corrupt form it was incorporated later with the legend of Faust, when that came to be chronicled in the 16th century. By a happy intuition, something like a revival of Manichaeism was contained also in the revival of Faust by Goethe. Julian thought in wide connections. His thoughts embraced all humanity. With such a man before us, it becomes very clear how narrow are the thoughts of ordinary men. It is necessary, for instance, that the teaching regarding the sons of men should take varied forms, according as man is himself capable of forming conceptions regarding his own nature. Naturally, the conceptions formed about the, in quotes, sons of man must be accorded to those formed of man. The one is dependent on the other. In the conception of this, men differ. They differ very greatly. At the present day, men have the most superficial understanding of such things. The word for man in Sanskrit is manushya. In this sound is expressed the root idea which a large part of mankind associate with the idea man. Manusha is M-A-N-U-S-H-Y-A. End of aside. When the root word manusha is used in describing man, what is it to which people refer? They refer to the spiritual part of man. They estimate man primarily as a spiritual being. When they wish to express the fact that he is a spirit, that he is but the manifestation of spirit, and consider this the thing of main importance, they use the word manusha, or some word derived from the same root. According to our teaching, there is another standpoint from which man can be considered. He may be considered mainly from the side of the soul. The man is then not thought of so much as spirit, but as soul. The outer physical part is allowed to sink more into the background, and that which expresses his soul nature is brought more to the fore. Now the soul nature finds visible expression in the fact that man stands upright, that he holds his head erect. If you examine the origin of the Greek word anthropos, you will find that this is just about what it expresses. Thus we may say, people who express the idea man by the word manusha, manushya, or some other similar blend of sounds, consider him primarily a spirit. Those who express him by some word resembling the Greek word anthropos, and this was especially the case with the Greeks themselves, look toward and give expression to the soul in man. There is a third way in which the idea of man can be expressed. It is possible to see in him mainly what is external, earth-born, the physical nature, that which comes to pass by physical means. This idea of man is expressed in the word homo, if the word is studied according to its origin. We have here clearly defined threefold way in which to consider man. And we can gather from this that a person such as Julian, who had knowledge of these matters, was justified in the instinct that made him look for a spiritual explanation of the words, quote, the Son of Man, close quote. He thought, quote, I have been initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries. It should therefore be possible for me to raise myself to the Persian mysteries and to receive the initiation that is in harmony with the teaching of the Manichaeans. By doing so, I might perhaps be enabled to promote that continuity in evolution for which I am striving. Close quote. This was a grand thought. Just as something other than the trivial conquest of Asia lay behind the expedition of Alexander the Great, so there also lay something other than the conquest of Persia behind Julian's expedition into that country. He desired to find out, with the help of the Persian mysteries, if he could not enter more profoundly into the task he had set before himself. To help us to understand this attitude of Julian, it might be well to ask what really was it that Augustine could not understand in the teaching of Manichaeism. I have already said that it is not possible at present to speak of the ultimate aims of Manichaeism, but we can always hint at some of its outworks. In his youth, Augustine was deeply attracted by these teachings. They made a profound impression on him. In later life, however, he exchanged the teachings of the Manichaeans for Catholicism. We ask ourselves what it was that he did not understand in Manichaeism. For what, in it, was he not sufficiently advanced? The Manichaeans did not form abstract ideas, nor ideas that cut off thought from reality. This would have been as impossible for them as it was for one who had been initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries. I have attempted elsewhere to show the difference between ideas that are purely logical and those that are in accordance with reality. In the teachings of the Manichaeans, the principle of making use of ideas that were in accord with reality always held the first place. Not that unreal ideas do not play their part in life. Unfortunately, they play a large part, especially at the present day. But it was of the very essence of Manichaeism to form conceptions that were not only thoughts, but which had sufficient force to play a part in external nature. To form such thoughts regarding Jesus Christ, as is done so frequently, would have been quite impossible for the Manichaeans. For what have these thoughts attained to? Verily, they have attained but to a very uncertain conception, to a very shadowy idea of the Christ, who incarnated in Jesus, through whom something of profound importance took place in earthly evolution. Ideas about Jesus Christ have become most dreadfully vague, especially in the 19th century. When we ask ourselves if that which Christian dogma ascribes to him and to his acts can lead to anything, when, with deep earnestness and love for truth, we desire to know this, we are forced to answer in the negative. If Christian ideas are not sufficiently powerful to think of the end of the world in such a way that it does not become the grave of humanity, but is able to carry humanity forward into a new form, if Christian ideas are not capable of thinking of the earth differently than as the naturalists of the present day describe it, saying that the earth will come to an end and the human race along with it, if they are not able to think of the evolution of the earth somewhat differently to this, then all their conceptions regarding Jesus Christ are really of no use at all. Even though they do hold that he is the cause of a certain activity in regard to the earth, the conceptions they form of him have not the power to raise matter to a height at which it can be conceived of as being capable of passing over from one earthly condition to another future condition. We have need of far more powerful ideas than those usually encountered before a beginning can be made with thoughts that are capable of grasping a future condition of the earth in such a way that we can carry the life of the earth over into a new existence. I said recently in a public lecture, present-day science seems to think, it calculates, that if the forces of nature, as they are today, were extended over millions of years, a condition would arise, I am taking this from a lecture of the Royal Institute, when if the walls of a room were painted with albumen, one would be able to read the papers by it, because it glowed. Again, a scientific investigator said, at that time milk will be solid, and will give forth a blue light, etc., etc. Such conceptions are, of course, the result of thinking that is vague as regards reality. All such calculations are exactly as if I were to study the conditions of the human stomach in respect of the changes it undergoes in a child of 5 years, and from these were to calculate what the condition of the stomach would be in 250 years. I might make certain discoveries by extending my calculations over all these years just as the scientist might picture earthly conditions a million years hence, so might I calculate the condition of the human stomach 250 years hence. Only, by that time, the man would be dead. The geologist's calculations as to the condition of the earth a million years from now are just as satisfactory as in the case of the organs of the child. Ideas are not capable of grasping reality in its fullness. Neither are the calculations of scientists of the least value as regards the partial realities they describe as those that will surround man 6 or 7 thousand years from now. Man must be thought of as in quite other conditions in the ages that are so far removed from our own. And it is in the sense of this human being of the future that the Christ is so necessary. In this connection, I once said, there is a difference between that which in the Middle Ages was called mystic marriage and that which in the sense of Christian Rosenkreutz was called chemical marriage. Mystic marriage is only an inward process. The chemical marriage of Christian Rosenkreutz pictured forces active in man which had power to affect the whole man, which could actually so transform him that when matter, like a crust, had fallen away from him, he would be able to pass over into the Jupiter, the Venus, and Vulcan ages. The whole content of Manichaeism was the conquest of evil, the conquest of matter by thought. That the question of evil should be grasped in its deeper sense, and in connection with this the whole question regarding Jesus Christ, was what occupied the soul of Julian. It was knowledge of this that he sought to gain, and bring back with him to Europe as the result of a Persian initiation. And lo, on this expedition he fell by the hand of an assassin. It can be proved historically that this was done by an adherent of Constantine. Thus we see how everywhere in history the attempt to establish what might be called the principle of continuity has had tragic results, and how in the case of Julian it led into a blind alley. After this, the Augustinian principle became dominant, vis-à-vis that people should not form ideas that in any way accorded with Manichaeism, that there should be no harmonizing of material thoughts with spiritual conceptions. Through this, the West was driven to an abstract mode of thought, and this method of thought continued until it permeated the whole of Western Europe. Only a few outstanding souls opposed this principle, and they were the great rebels against abstract thought. One of the most celebrated of these was Goethe, who, on account of his whole spiritual constitution, was strongly opposed to it, and one who succumbed to it the most was Kant. I know very well that in saying this I am speaking heretically. All the same, what I say is true. Take, for instance, Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and read his opening sentences. Every one of these can be changed into its opposite. They are so contrary to truth. Even the most important sentences in his teaching, about space and time, must be regarded in the same way. One might calmly turn each into its opposite, say yes where he says no, and no where he says yes, and in so doing one practically combats the theories that bar us from the spiritual world. You can gather what great interest Goethe, the great opponent of Kant, had in proving him wrong, by turning into its exact opposite, and proving to be false his saying, quote, "Into nature no creative spirit enters," close quote. Keeping this viewpoint in mind, we arrive at where we are best able to estimate the writings of Julian the Apostate against Pauline Christianity. This is a marvelous document, notable not so much because of what it contains, as because of what it contained in various writings of the 19th century. Let me read that sentence again. This is a marvelous document, notable not so much because of what it contains, as because of what is contained in various writings of the 19th century. This may appear paradoxical, but the facts are these. When we consider the writings of Julian the Apostate against Christianity, we find, gathered there, every possible argument against Christianity, against the historical Jesus, and against certain Christian dogmas. But everything is put with a true and powerful pathos, not a false pathos, with great pathos and true inwardness. When we consider his arguments and then pass on to examine the liberal theology of the 19th century, and see how, on the foundation of historical research, this denies to certain people the historical existence of Jesus Christ, when we consider the mass of literature produced in the 18th and early 19th centuries, which reveals the most thorough, painstaking, and philological investigation possible, when all this is considered, certain facts stand out clearly before us. The main criticism began with the comparison of the Gospels, where discrepancies were found between one and another. I have so frequently spoken of these matters that I need not repeat it here. When, however, the main points of difference are assembled, we find that they had all been stated already by Julian. Actually, nothing new has been brought forward in this respect in the 19th century. Julian had already mentioned them all. While he had spoken of these discrepancies with a certain geniality, the 19th century announces them with gigantic diligence, with profound theological learning and deep theological sophistry. I have already spoken of the titanic struggle undertaken by Julian, and that what really was at the back of his efforts, what he desired to bring about through the revival of Manichaeism, was a continuity in evolution. Bear in mind how the most advanced spirits, such as Goethe, had also experienced an instinctive pressure urging them to a revival of the learning and the spirit of ancient Greece. If Julian had been successful in his labors, it is difficult to estimate the effect this would have had on the people of his time. The necessity lying at the root of his failure to carry his work to completion must have light thrown on it from another side. It is not possible to understand this necessity if Julian is regarded in any way as a Philistine, if he is not recognized as a man who carried on a titanic struggle so that he might enter with human understanding into the reality of world conditions. It is specially important at this time that we should recall such great moments in the historical development of Western Europe, for we live in an age which cannot be passed through in a sound way, unless we try to understand what great souls like Julian the Apostate were endeavoring to carry out. The possibility had not as yet arisen in his time, and herein lies his great tragedy, of sowing the seed of the deepest essence of Christianity within the old principle of initiation. In our day this has become possible, and we must not neglect to turn the possibility into reality, if the world is not to enter on a downward evolution. People must realize the need of a revival in every realm of existence. Above all, they must realize and accept the principle of intercourse with the spiritual world. They must understand those things that work against this necessary revival. People are afraid of forming such clear conceptions in our day as was done by Julian. They are afraid of thinking deeply. Though there is great courage in our day, courage of the intellect does not exist. We have need, above all things, of intellectual courage. The man of today has no wish to face realities, to have a true reckoning with himself. This is the greatest need of our age. For if it is not to prove barren, there are some things it must learn. It must learn to understand the principle of the creative spirit. It must learn what is meant when it is said, the spirit, because it is creative, works with the same power as instinct, only instinct works in darkness. The spirit, become creative, works in the light of the sun, meaning the spiritual sun. This is what our age must learn to understand. Many things work in opposition to such knowledge in our day, in direct opposition to it. Cato, the Roman, whose main object was to establish a secure union of the states of the empire, considered it necessary, in order to accomplish this, to banish all the adherents of the philosophy of Greece. He said, "They only chatter, and that disturbs the enactment of our decrees." Machiavelli, the great Florentine of the Renaissance period, agreed with him, and especially commends Cato for banishing those who held forth in the state institutions from the standpoint of spiritual knowledge. Machiavelli also thoroughly appreciated the fact that on certain occasions the death sentence was employed in the Roman Empire in the interests of the solidarity of the social order. Intercourse with the spiritual world was something for which the Roman Empire and all that sprang therefrom had the bitterest enmity. Pains were therefore taken that the greatest uncertainty should prevail with regard to such matters, and they were hushed up as much as possible. Many things will have to melt away, as the snow melts in summer, if any adequate conception of the mystery of Golgotha is to be aroused in the world today, because of the radical heedlessness with which this mystery is approached. It is not pleasant to hear this. It is most unpleasant, but it will have to happen. Above all, it will have to happen in order that people may find a way to the real comprehension of the nature of Christ. At our next meeting, I will speak of how the human soul can draw directly near to this nature, or essence, of Christ in our day. Many fruitful ideas can be gained in respect of this, when we consider, on one hand, the figure who inaugurated what we might call the exoteric side of Western culture, that is, Constantine, and on the other hand, Julian the Apostate, who, in a way not possible for that age, endeavored to undertake the struggle against this exoteric side of Western evolution. It is noteworthy that if anyone with but a slight understanding, I will not say of occult facts, but of such occult facts as are still to be found in ancient writings, makes a study of Christian dogma, the most astounding things are disclosed. When, for instance, such things as the Mass are considered, with an understanding of occult matters derived from ancient writings, and when dogma and cults are studied in the light of this understanding, strange things are disclosed, things of such a nature that one is forced to inquire, what really do these dogmas contain, or what is contained in the ceremonies of these cults? Not only I, but countless writers have studied these matters from the standpoint referred to, and have come to the decision that there truly is an enormous amount of ancient paganism in cult and dogma, such a vast amount that one is forced to try and prove, as did the French writer Drach, who was a deeply learned Hebrew scholar, that everything contained in the dogma and the forms of worship of the Catholic Church is derived from paganism. These writers have further tried to show how certain persons have taken pains to conceal this fact, so that the world should not know how deeply paganism is implanted in the forms and dogmas of the Church. Now, it would have been strange if paganism had continued thus, quite unconsciously, and the question might well arise, to the preservation of which heathen service has the endurance of the Roman Empire contributed. If many recent writers are correct in saying that the Catholic service of the Mass, for instance, is the continuation of an ancient heathen sacrifice, and if Julian the Apostate used all his powers to preserve these ancient heathen customs so that they should not perish, then he has to a certain extent been successful. Countless problems of the highest importance, problems in quotes with thorns, as Nietzsche called them, arise from the study of great differences between Julian and Constantine. They are genuinely thorny problems, which are in the highest degree important to the men of today, but which must, all the same, remain unsolved problems to the present age. The end of Lecture 7.